Coming up, acclaimed author Sarah Shapiro reveals who is the one from her amazing book, Audience of One. Welcome to 613 Books Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Dean. And if you like to read a variety of books with authentic Jewish values, we read you loud and clear. My guest on this episode of 613 Books Podcast is Sarah Shapiro, the author of several books, including Audience of One. She is a public speaker and writing instructor who has been giving women's writing workshops since 1991. She has served as a magazine columnist and contributor for many publications. And in 2024, Stories of Our Lives, Volume 5 of the Our Lives Anthology series is set for release. Welcome to 613 Books Podcast, Sarah Shapiro.
Hi.
I'd like to start with asking you about someone you come to realize was your mentor within the piece that you title, Dear Daddy. You are writing about your father, Professor Norman Cousins, who was a best-selling author and journalist, as well as peace activist. And I remember hearing about your father's bestseller, Anatomy of an Illness, from my mother, also an optimist, who often spoke about how his book helped her appreciate the medicinal effect of laughter. So if you could just tell me a bit about Dear Daddy, in which you write about what a wonderful writer and editor he was, and the idea that, quote, what you gave over, Daddy, was not how to write, but how to live, end quote. You mentioned how he lived with integrity and avoided gossip and vulgarity.
Right. I mean, my father, one couldn't speak what I would later learn by Judaism is called Lashon Hara. You couldn't do that in his presence. He had like a Teflon surface about that. He just wouldn't take it. And I learned just by example from him, lying was not permitted. Lying was beneath one's dignity. And certainly vulgar speech. He didn't really explicitly instruct us as much as it would be an expression on his face, disapproval, and also primarily by example of what he practiced. So he was a good man. And when Mishpaha asked me who my mentor was for this article that you mentioned, I very kind of proudly said, well, I didn't have a mentor. And then I very quickly realized that's not true. It was my father. And he loved words. And I have a copy of the thesaurus that he entered, March's thesaurus. And he inscribed it, and I must have been about 14 at the time, and he said to Sarah Kitt, who knows that everything begins with the right word.
Beautiful. That's so nice. You know, throughout your book, Audience of One, you let us in to some of the inner workings and thoughts and outlooks of family members of yours in a very honest way. And I'd like to talk about your exquisite piece called Rain. In just 4 pages, one could say that this piece begins with the creation story and culminates in recent history, but it's more precisely a look into the life paths and choices that we and our loved ones make over time, especially how two sisters, you and your sister, have vastly different relationships with God and can appreciate something like rain at its source. I'm just wondering if you would tell us a bit about your approach to writing, about how siblings or relatives in general must sometimes agree to avoid certain topics of conversation, like religion.
Okay, well, first of all, writing about other people is a big challenge in itself. I never have forgotten something that my other sister, Candace, once told me, that she used to live next door to I have to be careful even when I'm giving over this story. She lived next door to a relative of a very famous novelist whose name I will remember not to say. And this relative of this novelist told my sister that everybody in the family hated, I'll give him the name, John. Everybody hated John in the family because they recognized themselves in his novels and they felt used. And of course, I'm not a fiction writer. I'm a nonfiction writer. I wish that I could write fiction, and I don't feel capable of writing fiction because the way my mind works, the whole process is trying to see what is there, what I think, what is there, what do I see, and trying to catch it and trying to get it down, trying to, you know, catch the moment as it flies. And so it's the only time that I've experienced the joy of writing fiction is when I'm editing other people's fiction. And then I love it. There's a certain freedom in writing fiction. But in any case, to get back onto topic.
Sarah, I just want to jump in. And can you go with that thought of why it is that you gravitate toward writing nonfiction?
I think because what motivates me is this desire for truth. And I've noticed that when I'm editing other people's fiction, once I get into a character, then I can, you know, sort of use my telescope to try to see how this character would respond, how he would think in a certain situation. But usually when I'm writing my own, about my own life or about people I know, I'm trying to find out what I think and what the person before me thinks and what's happening before me. So I myself have wondered, why can't I write fiction? But I think that's it. That it's just that I have this very strong instinct for looking for the truth, and I trust truth. I trust truth very much to bring us to an answer in the small way and in the large way. So this one time, I mean, it's happened to me quite often that people have said to me, how could you have written this about yourself? And it's an interesting subject for me. I trust that what I experience in my own Yetzirah is something that other people will recognize as something in themselves, not the specific expression of the Yetzirah, but the fact that we have a Yetzirah, and the fact that Rabbi Shimshon Pinchas said something which I love, and that is, he said, the most beautiful thing in all creation is the Yetzirah, because without it, life would have no meaning. So the Yetzirah, which is the inclination in every human being toward evil, which includes selfishness, vindictiveness, the whole, I mean, egotistical behavior and thought, you know, the whole, everything that the Yetzirah, the inclination toward evil, can encompass. Animals, they have their nature. I watch the crows outside in my porch, my merpeset here in Israel. And the crow that I see here in Jerusalem is precisely the same crow that I see when I visited my sister recently in Massachusetts. It's the same personality. You know, the crow, the animal, doesn't have to overcome his nature. It's the gift to the human being that we have to overcome our nature, and that's where the excitement of life is. And as Shimshon Pinchas says, that's without it, life would have no meaning. So not long ago, somebody was talking to me about a story that's in the book Audience of One, in which I'm talking about a neighbor had asked me to borrow some sweet potatoes, and my worry about not having sweet potatoes for ourselves. And she said, aren't you ashamed about, you know, the selfishness? And I was sort of taken aback. I thought, no, I would be ashamed if I didn't try to overcome it, or if I didn't try to be truthful about it, I would be ashamed. But the fact that we have selfishness, the fact that we have the impulses in ourselves that we have the opportunity to prevail over, is a joy.
I'm glad you bring up the trip to Massachusetts because it brings us back to Rain, such a lovely essay. And my earlier question about your approach to writing about siblings where you just agree to avoid topics like religion. This is a major part of that story.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, I think that most people don't have, at least initially, a religious perspective, don't like having it pushed at them. Because even a person who is not religiously observant has a very private inner place where the soul is with God. And I think it's, you know, Rev Tauber, Israel Tauber, says in his book, Thoughts for a Jewish Heart, that every human being is in Heder Yehud with Hashem. Heder Yehud is the room that a Kala and a Chassan go after the marriage ceremony when they are alone and nobody else can come into that room. And a person to Hashem has, according to Rabbi Tauber, a relationship as if he or she is the Kala of Hashem, and nobody can come into that room, that private room, that private inner room where you have a relationship with God. So I see with my sisters, the sister in this particular story who calls herself an atheist, I see that there's a sensitivity there to any kind of prodding on my part. I've seen through the years that the best advice is for me to be quiet. And the main thing that I can do as far as Kiruv goes, you know, to influence anyone else to open one's eyes is to not hide one's own observance. And that was the struggle for me with my sister. I have since learned that that story that I wrote, the incident took place around 2018, and it took me a few years to write that story. In fact, even after it was published in the book, I continued trying to perfect it. And I have learned since I wrote that story was painful for me because I missed an opportunity to have my sister see for herself that God answers prayers, God hears prayers. And because I was so shy and so tentative, I feel that I lost an opportunity to sanctify the name of God. So now when I go to see my sister, she's ill right now, and I've gone a few times in the last few months. I'm going to be going again in January, God willing. I pray in front of her. I say brachas in front of her. I take out my sitter, you know, and she'll say, what's that book? And I'll say, that is my prayer book. It's called a sitter. Say, oh, you know, and it's turned out to be a lovely experience. And in fact, I even had an opportunity to pray for something in her presence. And I did it this time. I learned my lesson. And it was mainly through writing about that story that it impressed itself upon me, the lesson that I had to learn, which is what writing can do. I mean, I feel writing is a way to discover oneself and to discover life and to hold on to life before it flies away. So the thing that happened now, which I want to write about, which is when I went to see my sister, there's no kosher food in her area. And a friend of mine contacted Chabad for me, and they said that they would bring over food. And I gave her the address to come. And it was around 20 minutes before Shabbat. She had said that she would come in the late afternoon, and it was about 20 minutes before Shabbat, and she hadn't come. And there was no kosher food for me, and I was responsible for cooking for my sister because she's not well. And I was becoming frantic how I have to give my sister food and we have no food for Shabbat. And, you know, she lived in a very rural area way out in the, I was going to say the boondocks, whatever that is. And I said in front of my sister, I said, "Dear God, please send us food. I know you want us to have food for Shabbat." And she kind of looked at me, you know, with her raised eyebrow. But I knew I had to do it. Whether or not we got food, I wanted to correct my error. I wanted to do a tikkun on my former mistake. And she didn't know the number of her neighbor. But she said, "Can you go over there and ask them if we can have dinner over there?" This was Friday night. Now, I knew I wouldn't be able to eat, but at least I knew that if they were her friends, they would give her dinner. So I said, "Where are they?" Now, in this area of Massachusetts, their beautiful houses are very far apart from each other, a lot of them, with a lot of woods in between and everything like this. And I said, "Where is the house?" And she said, "Over there." And she pointed into the woods. I saw nothing. And I said, "But where's the house?" And she said, "Well, it's a yellow house. You'll find it." So I started walking off. I couldn't even get through the brambles. You know, I couldn't find the house. And I was so upset and I was getting very angry at this situation. And I finally walked all the way around. I found the house. I knocked on the door. There were dogs barking inside, but nobody was home. So I didn't want to walk back through the woods. So I walked to the street. Now, this street has, you know, the mailboxes are far removed from each other, but I saw another house. And I said, "Are you the Warners?" And the woman who was just coming out of her driveway said, no, they're over there." Well, I didn't want to go back there again, of course. And so very frustrated, I started walking back toward my sister's. And I see in front of me a woman. And I think to myself, that's odd. Are there from people here? Because here was a woman who was obviously an Orthodox lady with a shadel. And she had in her hand a tray of food. I mean, I could see that it was like piled up. And she said, "Hi, I'm Zahava." I started to cry. This woman, if I hadn't gone outside looking, because my sister had told me to go looking for somebody where she could have dinner, I wouldn't have run into the Chabad woman who was looking for my sister's house. My sister's house is so far off the road and in such a hidden place that she couldn't find it. And, you know, I was just so happy. She drove me back to my sister's house and I told my sister, "Look, we have the dinner." So that's the happy story about that. And I don't think that it would have happened had I not written about the first chapter of that experience.
Wow. Very interesting. So let's talk about the actual essay called An Audience of One, which is also the title of your book. The essay begins on page 110. And I'm wondering if you would tell us a bit about the person you're speaking with in the essay and the decision that he made to overcome the inclination to speak to others in order to impress them is to play to an audience of one.
Well, you know, what Rabbi Revson, who's the head of Neve Seminary for Women in Jerusalem, what he was talking about with an audience of one is that what his point was that if one is living for and acting for the admiration of human beings, it won't get you very far. But if you have in mind that Hashem is the one who we want to be happy with our actions and with our thoughts, it's a direction toward a more authentic way of living. So I would say that, you know, living for Hashem's approval is, in a way, it's like a abbreviated way of talking about the whole struggle of life. When Rabbi Revson spoke about living for an audience of one and behaving and doing one's acts in life and one's deeds for an audience of one, he was talking about, of course, trying not to live for the approval and admiration from human beings, but from our creator. So I have a thing on my bulletin board that I read often and reread often, and it says it's from one of the Hasidic masters. Our sages teach that he who chases after honor, honor flees from him. But do we not find honor seekers who do indeed attain it? The answer is that they actually receive nothing. After all, the recognition they are given is never enough, and they are left feeling empty and slighted. To them, honor is elusive, forever fleeing. And the irony is that it's also written, it's that also something, a question that I asked Rabbi Repson in that interview is, well, isn't it written that there's one Yetzirah that increases with age, and that is the desire for honor. And it's a well-designed phenomenon that Hashem creates for us, because as we get closer to death, we want more and more to know that something of us will remain, you know, that our name doesn't disappear. But in most cases, our names do disappear. I mean, if we think of all the millions of people who lived, let's say, or all the people who live right now, in 70 years or even less, most of us, our names will mean nothing except to those people who have also died along with us, who loved us or hated us, God forbid. So to my husband, Colman Rosenbaum, has said, you know, if you're helping a little old lady across the street and the reason you're doing it is because you want the people who are standing there looking at you to think what a fine fellow you are, you can, you know, take her across the street anyway. Don't refrain from doing a good deed because you know that you're doing it for the wrong reason. I think that so often we are doing things for the wrong reason, but nevertheless, to do it anyway. But I think the difference is, do we know why we're doing it? I mean, sometimes we are doing it for the right reason. In fact, many times we are, and many times we're not. But just to know the difference and to try to do the right thing anyway.
Right. Thank you for that. In the time that we have remaining, I'd like to also speak with you about a common occurrence throughout your book, which contains quite a number of essays about writing itself, and in particular, how honest and real you are with your readers about your writing. You write about writer's block, how utterly distracting the internet is to a writer, to the point of sucking the creativity out of a writer down a rabbit hole of clicks, and that you have come to a place of acceptance. If you don't remember exact words or titles of a poem by Robert Frost, and avoiding Googling the answers is probably because, you know, that will lead to a trip around the world far away from your writing.
No, that wasn't the reason. The reason I said that I would rather not Google, if I can't think of something, whether it's a poem by Robert Frost or anything else, I try to refrain from immediately looking it up on Google, because I think that the brain has to have the exercise of thinking. And, you know, it's a very common human experience to try to remember something. And there's kind of a getting the answer too quickly from an exterior source without even having to open a book from the bookshelf and go through a dictionary. Or, I mean, the fact that we can just press a button and get the answer, I feel shortchanges our own minds and it weakens our minds. I do think that one has to be very careful of not allowing the technological ease of having the computer do what one's brain used to do. I was going to say it's like a kind of a chas v'shalom, a suicide in a way, because we're not developing our own mind. It's like losing one's mind. And when people praise the ease of artificial intelligence, I feel that we don't realize what we're sacrificing. So that was the reason that I didn't want to look up something on Google. that I was trying to search around in my memory.
And to include even that process in your writing that you are publishing, it's so revolutionary. Like, you are on the page giving ourselves permission to include those very human, imperfect pieces of ourselves in our writing. And that, as you've exemplified, that can also be fine writing too.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I know that what am I interested in if I read somebody else's writing? I want to know what their struggle is. I want to know what their true experience of life is. I'm not interested in having a prefabricated meal from somebody who is not sharing the truth of his own life. I feel that we can really be of use to one another if we share what's really going on. And I trust it. I do trust it very much. I mean, there's a certain discretion that one has to use, particularly, of course, in relation to other people's struggles. You have to be careful. And I also feel that one has to avoid sensationalism, you know, not to write about something because it's a splash. But I think that over the years, one can develop a sensitivity to the difference between sharing the real struggle that one has as a human being and differentiating that from, again, the desire for attention, the desire to get somebody to look. People want attention and people need attention. Children need attention. Adults need attention. We need to give each other attention. But we just have to remember that the attention we really need and the attention that we have is from God. God's attention. We do have God's attention. And no amount of attention from other human beings is going to satisfy the craving that we have to be heard and to be known. That's something that will only be satisfied really between a person and God.
That's a beautiful note to end on. And that your writing reflects a very, very human experience. And I want to thank you so much, Sarah Shapiro, for speaking with me about your book, An Audience of One, and the Art of Writing a Bit on 613 Books Podcast.
Thank you very much.
You can contact Sarah Shapiro directly by email at sarahkit@gmail.com. That's sarahkit@gmail.com. Sarah's email address is also in the show notes to this episode, as well as a link to purchase Audience of One. And that's what's on the shelf for this episode of 613 Books Podcast. I'm Heather Dean. Thanks for listening.
613 Books Podcast is produced and hosted by Heather Dean. Senior producer and director of operations, Greg Cohen. Consulting producer, Yiska Roth. Show announcer, Michael Doniger. Remember to like and subscribe to our show on your favorite app, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your own preferred app, and never miss an episode. You can find all episodes of 613 Books Podcast by visiting our website, heatherdeanproductions.com.